in reaction to that, a lot of Jews fled from Jerusalem and holed up, not at Masada, it had long since been established, but at a Roman fortress 15 miles south of Qumran, a place called Masada. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Would you say it with me? Masada, 15 miles south of Qumran. I'm still in history. The 10th Roman Legion was dispatched to go north to the Sea of Galilee and come down through the valley and clean out all vestiges of Jewish life. They spent their last weekend in Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee. I'll tell you how I know in a few minutes. I think word got to Qumran, the Romans are coming down the valley. They will kill us. What to do? I couldn't prove this if my jugular vein depended on it, but I think one morning, about 72 or so, they called together the community. And I think the head of the monastery said, send a message down to the flax plant, new linen. Send a message down to the pottery plant, new jars. And then I think the head of the monastery said with tears in his eyes, the 10th Roman Legion is coming. Incidentally, the journal of the 10th Roman Legion stops in Tiberias. We don't know why. The 10th Roman Legion is coming. What happens to us, said the head of the monastery? That is not particularly important. We believe in immortality. But what happens to the scrolls on which the holy name of God is written, that name we have not pronounced? That is a matter of importance. The tetragrammaton, may I use that kind of vocabulary, the four beautiful characters, must not fall into the hands of the Roman infidel. And I think the head of the monastery said to the brothers, go into the library and take off the pegs, the scroll you've been working with lately, the one your family sent as a thank offering when you joined the monastery, the one your mother-in-law sent in jubilation because you left home. Take them, wrap them in clean linen, put them in big jars, take them up in the hills, hide them. The Romans will come, the Romans will go. And I think they were working away quietly at that, not hurrying. Whoever joined a monastery to hurry? It's ridiculous. And one morning they got up early and they looked out across, and there, down on the beach, way ahead of anticipated schedule, was the 10th Roman Legion. What to do? I reckon the monks worked harder and faster that morning than they had since they left home. I reckon they moved into the library, I couldn't prove this if I had to, and simply scooped up arms fulls of manuscripts and ran to the nearest hole on the site. There wasn't time to shinny up there and become a shot target. Ran to the nearest hole in the floor and simply dumped more than half of all the scrolls we found at Qumran. Can you imagine what it was like when DeVoe and Harding walked into Qumran Cave number 4, and there, like a pile of shelled corn in the middle of a granary, peppered over with dust and sand, untouched for 2,000 years, a pile of manuscripts that you could pick up and unfold and read. Good heavens. That really gets us off of our chronological snobbery, doesn't it? We in the West who think the Methodists have arrived because we're going to celebrate our bicentennial. We haven't even been born yet. My wife happens to be an Egyptian. Don't ask how it happened. Some things don't need to be talked about on Sunday, but nonetheless. When we moved to Lexington, Massachusetts, some of the local DAR took Lila down to Lexington Green and said, see that house? It's almost 100 years old. And my wife, who'd grown up with a pyramid in her backyard from 3400 BC, was not very much impressed. Can you hear it? I said to a student the other day, you know, the Great Pyramid at Giza was already 1500 years old when Moses came. So, you know, there are ancient libraries. So, more than half of all the manuscripts fell right here in this cave. And I want us to think about that. What happened to the brothers at Qumran? That's a fair question. I wish I could answer it. I don't know. But the very fact that I don't know is very interesting. I think probably the 10th Roman Legion coming down through that valley had got sick and tired of the stinking valley of the Jordan. Somebody said, what happened to the brothers at Qumran? That's easy. They became Christians. To which my answer is, dummy, do you think that the Roman legions had Baptist tracts in their back pocket and said, if you guys will just sign on the dotted line, we'll let you out? I think the Roman soldiers were saying, what in the name of Zeus are we doing here? And they were dreaming of the bubbly Germanic wine and the bubbly Germanic girls back in the Via Veneto in Rome. Why do I think in these terms? I'm sorry, I should apologize. This is a Christian community, isn't it? Excuse me. And I think they were saying, the sooner we get back out of this place, the better off we'll be. And I think if in June of 70 or 72, you'd been sitting up on the Judean hills and seen the 10th Roman Legion attack, you would understand why we've never heard of Qumran. I think you would have heard the death rattle in the throat of my brothers. I think you would have heard the whining of Damascene steel. I think you would have known why the Roman legion kicked up their heels and dropped 400 silver ducats, shekels, half of them from the town of Tiberias, where they spent their last Saturday night. You didn't think I was going to get back to that, did you? Hear it? And you say, my, do you have to be that bloody? And I will tell you that 6 weeks later, 15 miles south of Qumran, the same stinking 10th Roman legion hit Masada, which was a fortress of 1,000 Jews who had fled Jerusalem when the Romans captured it. And those 1,000 refugees at Masada, as every Jew worth his or her salt knows, shame on us that we don't, took a vow that if the Romans began to win, they, the Jews, would commit suicide and or kill each other. And when after 6 weeks of battle, the 10th Roman Legion climbed up on top of Mount Masada, out of 1,000 refugees, they found 2 old hags and 5 almost utterly desiccated babies. I don't think I'm exaggerating. I think the reason we didn't hear of Qumran was there wasn't anybody to tell us about it. And if you've been sitting on that rock up above on that fateful evening in 72 AD, was it June? I don't know. And you'd heard the death rattle. And you'd seen the Romans putting a torch to everything that would burn. That's why we find ashes. Wouldn't you have been strangely moved to know that as silence came over the place, it would not be broken again until in 1946, a desert boy threw a rock into a cave. And instead of hearing the bleating of a kid, he heard the resounding crash of pottery. Why bother you with the story? I've got 3 reasons. Do we have time? This taskmaster is getting very nervous. he thinks something better is going to happen over there. Let me try to be brief. The first one, because I'm a trained preacher, I have to say 4 different ways, just to see what. Reasons for bothering with the story of Qumran. First of all, from Qumran, we have got more than 550 identified biblical manuscripts. Let me put that same point another way. From Qumran, we have got 1 or more copies of every book of the Old Testament in Hebrew, except the book of Esther. Well, la-dee-da. If I'd been going to nominate, don't get mad if you got an aunt named Esther, who hasn't? If I'd been going to nominate one for exclusion, guess which one it would have been? Let me say it another way. From Qumran, we have got a preponderance of copies of 3 books of the Old Testament, Deuteronomy, Isaiah, the Psalms. If you know anything about the New Testament, you know it leans very hard on 3 books of the Old Testament. Chorus, Deuteronomy, Isaiah, Psalms. And I'm still on the first reason. 550, plus a lot of commercial stuff. More than one copy of everything except Esther. A preponderance of copies of 3 books. And according to the best of carbon 14 dating, scientific tests, judgment of writing, analysis of the ink, these Qumran texts date from about 50 of this era. In one place, we've found 1 or more copies of every book of the Old Testament, the Bible of Jesus and the early church, 1,000 years older than our previously oldest copies. Now, for that, I will get excited. Because that means that our biblical tradition was already being taken seriously, proving you can never do, but taken seriously for several hundred years before that. It wasn't a flippant thing, it was being cared for, put together. And you know, sometimes when I hear a bishop pontificating about the Bible, I would like to stick a hatpin in his pontificator. If I could find out where it is. Because it isn't we, it isn't bishops who give the Bible its integrity. It's 1,000 years. No, it's 3,000 years of people with uncorrected vision. I'm sorry. I've worn these since I was 15 months old. And for me, the horror of the Middle East is scribes who line the text with their noses. But they are the ones who kept the text for us, aren't they? They're the devout. They're the copyists. Second reason for bothering you with this is the fragment literature. My goodness, I'm hard up. Baskets and baskets and baskets of fragments. Tweezers under glass. When I taught at the American University, the president of the university was a man whom John Kennedy later appointed ambassador to Egypt. And I used to go to his table occasionally, seated one day next to a wife of a United States senator. One side, an English archaeologist, a well-corseted gentleman on my left. And the United States senator's wife leaned across her soup and me and a lot of other things and said to the English archaeologist, "What, in addition to a bulldozer and dynamite, do you use in your work?" And the Englishman said to Mrs. Munt, "A fingernail file and a toothbrush." She never knew what hit her. Tweezers under glass, fragment literature. A friend of mine is a Belgian priest. He's been working in the back rooms of the Rockefeller Museum for 37 years. Tweezers under. Nincompoops can't do this, you know, because you've got to be able to read a little Hebrew, a little Greek, a little Aramaic, so forth. Even affirmative action won't get nincompoops that. I had to put that in. But you know, that old priest is putting together another 51st Psalm. Another litany from a synagogue in the first century in Galilee. And one of these days, he's going to be a benefactor, like some of us rushing around will never be. The fragment literature. I've got a third reason. I want you to sense, please, that this group of Jews who were reaching out from Jerusalem, these Jews who were going to the desert, these Jews who believed in life after death, these Jews who sang psalms, that these were Pharisees. I'm tired of the fact that Pharisees is another word like nigger in the Christian church. It was the Pharisees who were talking about life after death. Read Daniel. It was the Pharisees who were talking about not recanting because you really believed something. It was the Pharisees who were talking about prayer. I believe Jesus was a Pharisee. I think John the Baptist was a Pharisee. Certainly weren't Sadducees. Certainly weren't zealots. What else is left? Oh, there were good and bad Pharisees. But I take my Lord seriously when he said, except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees, you're not going to be any different. The Pharisees are our fathers and mothers in the faith. They're the ones who said, bring the families together. Bring the women to the synagogue. They're the ones who said, bear your witness, and life will go on one way or another because God loves you. They're the ones who said, yes, not just Torah, but also prophets as a part of the lectionary. They're the ones who said, we can get along without the temple if we have to, because a synagogue is a place where you gather the people for the reading and study of Torah, the saying of prayers, and doing of social service. Oh, wow. Qumran reminds us that God didn't try with the nasty old Jews and say, wow, I'm not gotten any place. I've got to have an intertestamental period. And here come the Christians, rootless. No, Qumran reminds us that even though we are devoted to Jesus Christ, you never did see a great tree that didn't have deep roots, did you? And maybe I could stop this lecture if anybody can, by quoting George G. Nathan and speaking specifically of Jesus. Don't show me the flower without showing me the roots. Qumran is a part of the rootage of a healthy church. And when we know where we came from, we'll have a pretty good sense of where we can go. Lacking roots, I doubt that our branches can be far-reaching and strong. Thank you.
Now you know why I can still remember the lecture after 20 years.
Lanny, I got to be there, Dave. You're going to follow that.
I'm not following it. I'm only leading the parade. Do you have a couple questions? We do have a couple questions very quickly to of Harold Beck at this point.
Yes, sir.
Have there been other scrolls found?
Lots of stuff in Egypt, but we expected that because it's so dry. Lots of stuff in Tigris, Euphrates, as long as it was up off the valley. Palestine, no, rain. The only place in Palestine where we could have hoped for such a thing is deep down in that trough by the said Dead Sea, where the climate is arid enough that leather manuscripts could be preserved. Quite incredible.
Where are most of the scrolls now?
Most of the scrolls on the campus of the Hebrew University in a place called the House of the Book.
Do we still have some in the museum in Jerusalem?
There are some in the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem, yes. I want to say about this discovery, Qumran, thank you for that question. I want to say about this Qumran discovery. It has been one of the really enlightened, civilized, ecumenical discoveries in this sense, that any competent scholar could get almost immediately copies of the texts they've studied and used. And that's nice. There's been too much of this, you know. I found it. I'm going to make my reputation by publishing it, nonsense, in this part of the academic, as in a lot of parts of the academic world, you know. You shall seek the truth, and the truth will make you free after I make my career on it, which is not really quite good. Please.
Yes.
I said, I hope we all have Baptist propensity.
Well, did you, and when you were talking about the steps down into them,
yes.
Is there any thought that they...
Oh, yes, clearly. Baptism was not regarded as a naming rite or a kind of regeneration rite so much in Judaism to the degree that we do. It was regarded as a cleansing rite, and to that degree regenerating for two or three centuries before Christians took it over. Paul, John the Baptist and Jesus were exercising an already established Pharisaic practice. Now, we have read more into it, I think, as Christians. Am I being fair? But I think we've got to say in Judaism, the water as a regenerating, cleansing force. Could we dawdle on that just a minute? Water is very, you know, water is like fire in the Bible. Fire destroys, but fire is the symbol of the Spirit. The Semites hate water, in a sense. But they also regard it as a great liturgical symbol. And we can see why. You've seen a flood. But you also see how water is indispensable. So who brings those elements under useful control? Thanks be to God. That's a part of the power of those symbols, I think, that we want to bear in mind. I could go on that. But clearly, the practice of baptism, probably by immersion, was established in Judaism. Different definitions, but real similarity. Always cleansed. The reason I mention that water is, you know, in Revelation it says, and there will be a new heaven and a new earth, and there will be no sea there. Judaism has always been scared of the sea. Part of the meaning of Jonah is he needed to take his chances even on the sea rather than obey God, which leads Jonah in a very embarrassing position. Good. Other questions?
I think if you have any extra questions, you may want to talk with him afterwards. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.